and the use or misuse of any information featured in this program.
Transmission begins.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Here we go.
Let's go.
Doug, you've heard about America not wanting to fight, wanting to stay out of the war, is a lot of horse dung. Americans traditionally love to fight. All real Americans love the stick of battle.
I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty, or give me death.
Radio Free ARFCOM starts now.
Good evening, fellow ARFCOM members and anyone else out there listening. My name is Benjamin, and it's now time for your Radio Free ARFCOM, the Internet's voice for AR15.com, broadcasting live from my office here in South Florida. This is your show, so feel free to call us. I have the numbers listed on the show call-in schedule on AR15.com for tonight if you'd like to call in. The primary number is going to be 415-287-0074. And please visit the Radio Free ARFCOM forum on AR15.com if you'd like to follow along. I've also provided links there to the subject material of our guests. You can also go to the show topics thread for tonight's show and get the additional call-in numbers. I'd love for you to share your thoughts and comments with us here at Radio Free ARFCOM, and please visit AR15.com's site sponsor links and support Radio Free ARFCOM and AR15.com by purchasing a team membership in the AR15.com store. Also, don't forget about the AR15.com's Special Operations Support Raffle. Tickets are $10 and benefit our frontline special operators. You can find that on some of the site announcements on the AR15.com announcement page. We have a great show for you tonight, full of info and ARFCOM-worthy entertainment, so let's get started. As always, I encourage the listening audience to submit show topics, ideas, and potential guests as soon as possible so I can book them for you ahead of time. For you regulars, please encourage your ARFCOM friends, as well as friends and family, to listen to Radio Free ARFCOM. As you know, the more listeners we have, the more support we get, and can continue to make the show better for you, the audience. If you have any ideas for the show, please don't hesitate to let me know. Remember, I work for you, the AR15.com and Radio Free ARFCOM audience. For those of you on AR15.com right now, you can contact me via email at benjamin@AR15.com, or if you want to chat with me real quick during the show, just send me an instant message to Benjamin. Moving on tonight's show, we're going to recap last week's show. We're going to start off with listener comments. We're going to have some news briefs. We'll have our ARFCOM Fantasy Football update. We'll have our Armed Citizen. We got some really cool guests tonight. Of course, Joe DeBurglis of the NRA will be first, as always. We have Paul Darling, a Lieutenant Colonel of Infantry serving full-time in the Alaska National Guard. And he's got a really cool project going on right now called the Taliban Safari that he's going to come on and talk about. Also, we have Stephen Pajak, ARFCOM's own zombie author of the now-published book available on Amazon.com called Mad Swine. So check that out. That'll be our full-length zombie segment of the week tonight, talking to Stephen, and we're excited about that. On to the August 30th recap. Obviously, last week was Labor Day. We wanted to give our guests and myself a chance for a little bit of a breather. and, you know, give everybody a little bit of a break. So, at any rate, last week's show, again, we were off last week for the Labor Day holiday, so I hope you didn't mind. I just wanted to give us some time to breathe. On the August 30th show, we covered a variety of topics, including Colin, who was an Army infantry mortarman in the Iraq War, and we also had Brian on from AIM Surplus. So thanks again, guys, for taking the time to come on the air with us here at Radio Free ARFCOM. We had some nice comments from our listeners. One of our regular listeners, JNK556, said he was very pleased. He said, cool. He got Brian to come on. Brian, we talked about a bunch of ammo and stuff like that going on and the supply and the availability and all this stuff with the surplus market. So it's a very cool segment. Another member, MDW, said, cool, I'd like to hear more site sponsor interviews on the show. That was really cool, and we're going to definitely try to have as many site sponsors as want to come on the air with us. We had a neat photo here, again, of some people with some surplus ammo that they did get, you know, through Brian and through some other companies as well. Let's see here. We got the email about the NRA who said the EPA rejected and denied the petition. That was for the lead ammo ban that was floating around for a couple weeks there, scaring a lot of people. So there's a lot of cool stuff out here, and we got some really good comments from the last show. One of the comments was, is the show cutting in and out? You guys may or may not know, but we do broadcast via the internet, obviously, so from time to time there will be some quality issues with the connection. So if you're listening right now and you hear the show fading in or out, or my quality sounds really good or really bad, just give it a few minutes. It usually comes back shortly, so just bear with us. It is, again, going through the internet, nothing that we can control. But all in all, lots of positive comments, and we certainly appreciate all the responses and all the positive comments and criticism that you guys have. Again, this is your show. For the audience out there, if you guys want to hear something or want to tell me something, we really encourage you to post in the forum, give me a call here on the show, or send me an instant message. I'll be happy to talk to pretty much anybody. On upcoming shows in the next couple weeks, I have some really great guests on for all you Radio Free ARFCOM fans. Again, we're trying to get as many site sponsors on here, as well as just a variety of different guests from all walks of life. I'm going to continue the deployed or the veterans military interview segment as much as I can for any veterans out there or currently active duty soldiers, Marines, sailors, and airmen. We'd certainly love to hear from you to talk about some experiences. I think it's a really cool segment. I hope you guys enjoy it as much as I do talking to these veterans, and you know they certainly are the heroes of the modern generation. So thanks again for all your service. So like I said, if you are a veteran and you want to come on and talk about some of your experiences in the military, regardless of if you were in a war or not, just drop me a line to come be a guest here on Radio Free ARFCOM. It just takes a phone number, and we can pretty much patch you through from anywhere. I also said the other week that I would read ARFCOM's very own zombie novel, Mad Swine, by AR15.com member Stephen Pajak. Well, I've read the novel, and tonight we'll be speaking with Stephen about his novel, which is now published and is available now for you readers out there. If you like fiction, if you just want to support an ARFCOM member who took the plunge and went and got published, whether you like zombie genre or not, it'd be really cool to support those of us out here in the media realm and in ARFCOM internet land, just by showing some support for our fellow members and team members. So that's really cool. For those of you sports fans out there, I'm sure you're as excited as I am now that the NFL season is underway, and October is almost here for the baseball playoffs and the World Series. Well, in our own little corner of the sports universe sits the AR15.com Beans versus No Beans Fantasy Football League. And here is the update. Week one is all but over, save for tonight's Monday Night Football premiere. And we're going to go to the scores right now. We've got some really good matchups. We have Radio ARFCOM, which is, of course, my team. We're ahead 123 against Philip McCrevis at 77. He's got a couple players left to play tonight, I think four. I've got two players on Monday Night Football tonight. So if he can catch up and make it a potentially a good matchup. We've also got the LMT Defenders over top of the Herbie Kirby's, 110 to 72. We've got the Glowworms over the Buckeye Bruisers with a close matchup, 96.4 to 80.2. The EBR Patriots have 116.12 points over top of Shiver Me Milkbones, 92.26. And the close matchup of the week, Mr. Bond with 90.28 over the Thundercats, 86.42 coming up. This week, the scores should be finalized by the end of tonight with the final Monday night matchup. On week two, Radio Free ARFCOM will be up against the Herbie Kirby's, so please wish me some luck on that end, and good luck to all you fantasy fans out there, and keep us up to date on your teams and let us know how you're doing. And like I said, you know, if you or any other fantasy players want to get on the show and talk some smack about your team, your league, your players, or fantasy football or sports in general, just give me a call here on the show or drop me a line through ARFCOM. I think it'll be a lot of fun to follow everybody's progress here in the ARFCOM universe of fantasy sports. Now, we're going to go ahead and give you some news updates. From the NRA ILA, we have a couple of different issues here that's going on. One in particular coming from the Toronto Star. It says, gun registry won't save lives. It says, when domestic violence turns deadly in Canada, killers are far more likely to reach for a knife than a gun. They say that the weapon of choice for homicides is usually the one closest at hand, and that tends to be a knife. Basically, the columnist, Rosie DiMano, she says that in 2008, nine women were killed by a long gun, one by a handgun, and that firearm was not licensed, but 15 were stabbed and 8 strangled. They say that spousal homicide in general has been steadily declining for 3 decades, and that her point she makes is that the long gun registry, you know, they say it's just not helping. She says there may be good reasons for maintaining the 15-year-old registry, however faulty and unwieldy it's been in the application, but as legislated bulwark to save the lives of vulnerable women is not one of them, any more than accidental discharge can be prevented by a duly logged and properly provenanced firearm. So at least we have a little bit of sense coming from some of the folks up in the Great White North. Let's see, we have from Tennessee, the Chattanooga Times, coming up here. In the 15 months since Tennessee handgun carry permit holders got the right to go armed in state parks, 2 gun-related incidents have been reported at state facilities and neither resulted in violence. The legislation took effect in June 2009, and that allows permit holders to go armed in all 53 state parks and 81 natural areas. He said that there's been only one really major incident in which rangers stopped a man with an AK, handgun strapped over, but they actually released him for carrying the firearm because it was legal. So they say that the proponents of the permit holders argued that they'd be needed to protect themselves on state property, and that it was and that although the crime was rare, it should be certainly in our opinion here on Radio Free ARFCOM, you should be able to carry just about wherever you want, you know, because criminals certainly can, and nothing's stopping them. So yet another case of the a non-story, really, of, you know, nothing crazy happened just because you give people the ability to lawfully exercise their God-given rights. So, again, a non-story, but for our side, a good non-story. We have a story from here in Florida, in Jacksonville. The women take to the gun range to learn self-defense. They say there was a really nice turnout. Again, this is at this gun club here, Gateway Rifle and Pistol Club. More than 100 women had a event there, from going on introducing women, particularly new shooters, to learn how to shoot. They had one of the sheriffs, Sergeant Barbara Weber, speak about street smarts and defensive tactics. So just a real nice, well-attended event, making sure that women get an equal shot and an equal share of exposure to the firearm community. And remember, it's not just a guy thing to be a firearm owner and be concerned about self-defense. It's certainly something that we all need to consider. And, you know, if you're out there listening and you know somebody, whether it be a wife or a mother or a sister or an aunt or a cousin or something, that, you know, firearms are not just for guys. It's certainly up to all of us, in particular women, to be able to have the ability and the means to defend and protect ourselves. And if you have somebody in your life like that, let's just try to be encouraging, and let's try to take them out to the range and show them positive experiences with firearms, and give women, who obviously are a little bit more vulnerable to potential assaults and attacks and things of that nature, let's really try to, you know, make a difference in the women in our lives and give them the ability and the means to have the capability to defend themselves. God forbid anything should happen. The other thing, great thing that I'm really getting out of this article is for you listeners out there, you know, imagine how much joy you get when you go to the range yourself. You know, I love going to the range. I love taking my fiance or my mother or somebody, and shooting is one of those sports and skills that it doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter if you're a big, strong guy or you're a little old lady. Everybody can shoot. You know, it's a very non-gender-based set of movements and muscles that can be shared by all. So please encourage, again, this is from the Florida Times Union in Jacksonville, but please try to encourage the women in your life to get out there and do some shooting and learn the ways around firearms, not only for their safety, but also for just fun, because it's a great sport shared by all. Along the same lines, we have, according to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, from the citizen.com of a place called Laconia, says more than 125 women, many there to learn how to become hunters, spent the weekend in the Squam Lakes area. This is in up north in Massachusetts, but it's basically another event saying Wareham is part of a growing number of women interested in hunting. And according to the Fish and Wildlife Service, in 2006, the number of hunters nationwide was 12.5 million, down from 19.1 million in 1975. However, in 2006, the study made up 9%, or 1.2 million, well, women made up of the 12.5 million hunters in the U.S., showing a slight increase. In addition, the report noted that 304,000 girls aged 6 to 15 hunted from 2001 to 2006, which is a 50% increase over the period of 91 through 96. So obviously we have a number of people, a number of women growing in their love for the outdoors and hunting and firearms, and that's certainly something we want to encourage whenever we can. Continuing on, we have a story here that I found. Let's see, where is it? It's the Gun News Daily. This is something that it's hard to say. It's very, very frustrating, but our friend and our president, Mr. Obama, says Obama administration moves to block the sale of M1 rifles to law-abiding Americans. Now, those of you not familiar, there's in South Korea a couple hundred thousand M1s, carbines, and M1 Garand surplus rifles, and our friends in the White House decided that they should not be for sale to law-abiding American citizens, and now they're thinking about, instead of providing these surplus rifles for us hunters and target shooters and collectors, they're going to melt them down. That's fantastic. So here is the story from AmmoLand.com. It says, apparently things are going so well in the Middle East that the State Department now feels it can turn its attention to banning the lawful possession of firearms by American citizens. Here's the key point. In a little notice decision in March, the Obama administration reversed an earlier decision and moved to block the importation of 857,470, that's 850,000, folks, lawful M1 semi-automatics, which were being sold by South Korea in an effort to raise money for its military. According to the State Department of Hillary Clinton, this action was taken because the M1As, quote, could potentially be exploited for illicit purposes. They also left the impression that these historic relics could even be melted down. And it's just, if that's not enough to get your blood boiling, I don't know what will. I mean, here you have, when do you even, let me ask you people a rhetorical question here, those out there listening. When was the last time you heard, or if you ever heard, of someone going into a bank with an M1 Garand, you know, a 10-pound rifle to rob the place, or using an M1 rifle in a drive-by shooting? I mean, it's almost unfathomable the arrogance of these people, and just they understand that. I mean, they certainly know their audience. They understand that the majority of American citizens wouldn't know an M1 Garand or carbine from an AK-47, but the point being is that these are semi-automatic rifles. They're collectible. They're not making them anymore. They're getting already a great demand and price in the marketplace. And here you have a potential chance to have some 850,000 of these rifles hit the market for law-abiding citizens, shooters, collectors, and hunters such as myself, such as I'm sure many of you AR15.com members, and, well, no, they're just going to melt them down. The hell with it. I mean, it's just, it just absolutely makes me want to smash my head into the wall. But there's our friend Mr. Obama in the White House, and yet another reason to, say what you want about his decision-making process. Anyway, moving on. Give me one second. We just got an instant message here. But anyway, continuing, if that's not enough to get your blood boiling, I don't know what will. We also have the armed citizen column, as we always do. This will at least make you feel a little bit better, I hope. A homeowner in Charlotte, North Carolina, was awakened in bed by the sound of his doorbell. After getting out of bed, the homeowner heard a crash, which was an intruder throwing a brick through a window. The homeowner retrieved a shotgun and fired it at the window as the invader attempted to climb into it, thereby causing that criminal to flee the scene. That was in Charlotte. So, again, another story of a law-abiding citizen using a firearm for self-defense or home protection. Relating back to that previous story, I mean, who's to say that a citizen couldn't use that surplus rifle, that M1, that M1 Garand, that M1 carbine for a relatively inexpensive method of home defense? I mean, surplus rifles are great for that. they may, are they ideal? Who knows? But the potential is there that the, you know, with the cost of everything in life now seemingly increasing, with inflation going up, and with still a very high demand for firearms out there, people are scared right now because the economy stinks. There's a lot of desperate criminals out there, and here you have a potential of a flood of very nice rifles that could hit the market. I mean, imagine what the price would be if 850,000 more Garands and carbines went on the market. That price would plummet, giving people who potentially couldn't afford it before the means, the wherewithal financially to now purchase a rifle or a carbine for self-defense. It just, it really aggravates me that they would do something just so blatantly. I mean, it's just horrible. I don't even have the words for it. So do what you can. There's a link on there on that MLN story. You can write your representative. You know, you gotta be active, people. We gotta try to do something for this administration to stop it. I mean, between them walking all over our rights, between them, you know, blocking the sale of these firearms, I mean, it just goes on and on. Really making me stressed out here, folks. Apologize, but it's a big issue, and it's just getting worse and worse. Anyway, from the NRA, we do have some more good news. The NRA is challenging the constitutionality of a federal handgun ban for law-abiding 18 to 20-year-olds. This is on the NRA ILA website. Excuse me. It says, the NRA is challenging a federal law that prohibits law-abiding Americans 18 through 20 years of age from legally purchasing a handgun through an FFL. The case was filed Tuesday evening in the United States District Court for Northern Texas. Mr. James DeCruz of Lubbock is the plaintiff. Basically, the suit asserts, at 18 years of age, law-abiding citizens in this country are considered adults for almost all purposes, and certainly for the purpose of the exercise of fundamental constitutional rights. Indeed, at 18, citizens are eligible to serve in the military, to use arms, obviously, for fighting in the military. There's, you know, for self-defense, there's all kinds of things that, you know, voting, driving. People are adults, and yet they can't own a handgun, so the NRA is challenging that. So read up on that. Again, that's at the NRAILA.org website. And speaking of the NRA, we have our frequent guest, Mr. Joe DeBurgolis, on the line with us here tonight to talk about all things NRA. Maybe we can touch on some of these issues we just covered. We had a week off, so we haven't heard from Joe in 2 weeks. So tell us what's going on, Joe. It's always nice to have you, and it's nice to have you back.
Thanks, Ben. I greatly appreciate being here, and just came back from attending the NRA fall board meetings and discussed many of the things that you covered in your monologue.
And let me just ask you here right off the bat, And you don't necessarily have to give the NRA official opinion, but what's your take on this whole deal with the M1 rifles from Korea? Instead of them selling these perfectly good and collectible and historic arms, they're going to take them and melt them down?
Well, I tell you, this is a play right out of the Clinton playbook, and it doesn't take long from the husband, the Clinton administration, to pass it to his wife, the current Secretary of State. Basically, during President Clinton's reign, he did the same thing. And for people out there who care to contact somebody, make sure your congressperson gets a telephone call, email, or snail mail, and politely state that you would hope that they contact the Department of State, because this is where this issue lies, and to encourage Secretary Clinton to reverse the decision. He's the one basically that's involved in this, and the decision was made under her aegis. The overall feeling, my feeling, is it's colossal waste. It should be released to the American public. It no different than any other of the M1s that have been released through either CMP or other sources. And I shake my head every time it goes to something like this, Ben, because, frankly, there's no rhyme or reason for it. I know you touched on various things. They're not used to further or enhance a crime being committed. Most of these things are relics that are cared for, utilized, and placed in a position of honor in one's home. It's not something that's readily used. I mean, short from the latest Clint Eastwood movie, not really portrayed in anything less than a war movie. They're a fine shooting rifle, and it just boggles the mind sometimes at what our government does. It spends our funds on.
Yeah, mind-boggling and incredibly frustrating would be the words that and anger would be the words that come to my state of mind when I hear stuff like that.
I mean, you sit back and it's something we talk about. We're on point. The NRA is asking everyone out there. It was one of our action alerts to contact the representatives. When they get back in session, get down to business. Hopefully, they'll look at this, and we're going to put our finger on the pulse and see how far we can drive this thing up. It's something that we definitely are monitoring, and it's again, it's just something that we're don't need to go through, but we will definitely pursue every avenue to reverse that decision.
Now you said you'd attended the meeting with the NRA board recently. Can you tell me a little bit about that, and what are some of the hot topics that y'all discussed there, and what are some of the things that we can look forward to coming down the pike?
Well, a lot of the things I can't because it's something of a closed session, but some of the things I can touch on is this. Many of the hot topic issues that are listed on NRAILA.org are the very things that we talk about. We're in full primary season now. As a matter of fact, tomorrow's primary day here in New York. So we have a hotly contested governor's primary on the Republican side. So we're trying for another one of these grassroots efforts. We've been looking at and endorsing Carol Palladino and his the pro-gun candidate in the Republican side against anti-gun Rick Lazio. So we'll be checking that and getting the vote out for Mr. Palladino. But a lot of the things that are covered in the board meeting are the same things that basically, if you read the threads, NRA activism, I bring up telemarketing, periodicals, our magazines, article insertion, what people here on ARFCOM tell me. I try to relate to our directors and our great employees at the NRA so we can modify and mollify, basically, their complaints if they have any. We have committee meetings. Two of the committees that I serve on this particular time through had meetings. That's grassroots, political grassroots, getting the vote out, that kind of stuff, and education and training. So you meet in committees. And then you report off from the committees. So it's basically similar to that how Congress acts. There's 76 of us. So we go in for committee work, then we report out as a board. Some of the other highlights is that we awarded our annual awards. One was Law Enforcement Officer of the Year. I had the distinct privilege and honor to meet Dave Lawler. If anybody has the opportunity to go to NRA.org and read his write-up, he's a true hero. He's a sergeant from the Northwest Sheriff's Department and did a great job in taking down a hostage-taking suspect. He was there. We had two individuals that were named through the grassroots division of NRA ILA as Volunteer of the Years, the Jay Learfield Volunteer of the Years. One was Ken Henson, who did a great job in the Buckeye Firearms Association. And the other was Mark Becker down in Florida. And I nominated both of them, and thankfully both of them were accepted and received, so that was great. The Illinois State Rifle Association, they were the state affiliate of the year. They do a fantastic job in Illinois, and some of the major decisions that recently came forth was due to the due diligence of their executive director, Mr. So we had a variety of different students and junior shooters that were awarded and celebrated and feted. out there. So it's kind of a two-day celebration to make sure everything is noted. We try to tweak what people perceive as wrong, and we have some discussion about where we're going to go in the future. That's basically what transpires in a board meeting during the time that I was up there, my friend.
Now, one of the things that's up here on the NRA Iowa website, and I think it's a pretty big deal because it seems to be one of those issues that just makes sense. And it's what I touched on, the NRA challenging the constitutionality of the federal handgun ban for law-abiding 18 to 20-year-olds. Now, most law, like they say here, okay, the law is, it prohibits Americans 18 through 20 from legally purchasing a handgun through a licensed FFL. Now, that's not to say that you're not, in many states, or the free states, whatever you want to call them, that individuals who are 18 to 20 years old can't own a handgun. They just can't purchase it through an FFL. So if you have a son or a daughter or a cousin or a brother or sister and you decide, hey, I'm going to get them a Ruger Mark III for a birthday present so they can learn to target shoot with me, or I'm going to get him a 1911 so he can have a self-defense for his home, that's perfectly legal. But that same individual can't, for the most part, have a concealed weapons permit, at least not in Florida, and they also couldn't walk into a gun store like where I work and actually purchase a handgun legally from somebody like an FFL like we hold. So here we have this case that the NRA is challenging. It says, the plaintiff, Mr. DeCruz, is well-trained in the proper handling and use of firearms, including handguns. It says his initial training was with his grandfather. He wanted him to know safe and proper techniques for use in storing firearms. Mr. DeCruz was a member of the Navy, JROTC, rank in good standing. He's got a bunch of awards. He's got awards for marksmanship. He's got all kinds of stuff. So here you have a very decorated young man, at least at that point in his life, that for no other reason than his age, he's being denied his God-given constitutionally enumerated right to own, or excuse me, purchase a handgun for self-defense. What's your take on that, Joe? And where do we see this going? And why is now the right time for the NRA to jump on this?
Well, I follow and echo the comments that you just made, Ben. It's something where we believe that an accomplished individual, such as Mr. DeCruz, has the right purchase a firearm. The reason why we can go forward with this type of lawsuit now is because the climate has changed based upon all the great work from all the organizations through Heller and McDonald. And you're going to start seeing, as we spoke about on various shows throughout the last couple months, these type of challenges coming down the pike. These are situations where now the Second Amendment is incorporated. We're going to start going on a case-by-case basis. It's going to take some time, guys. Now, this isn't something that's going to be handled in the next week, possibly month, or several months. It may take a year or two, but we're going to start looking at these things. I often use, and I know he's listening, my good friend Dan's analogy is, we got to look for the smoke to clear the barrel a little bit. But this case in particular has taken precedence. We're going to go forward with it because we believe that an individual has the right, especially an accomplished one, such as Mr. DeCruz, to have the ability to purchase whatever firearm you would like. So I am in full agreement with your assessment, Ben, and we're going to push forward. I think we're going to be successful in it, but time will tell.
I think one of the important things to remember, in particular, because firearms laws are so crazy and so complex and so varied between state to state and federal, is that the problem that you encounter with somebody like Mr. DeCruz is that if, for example, he wants to own a firearm, unless it was a legitimate gift, there's the whole issue of the straw man argument that could be construed or prosecuted through the ATF. In other words, say you have a gentleman like Mr. Cruz who decides, yes, I would like to own a handgun, Well, if he has a part-time job, like I'm sure, you know, many 18-year-old kids do, and he goes out and he saves his money that he lawfully earned, and then he says, hey, Dad, you know, can I get a firearm? Yeah. But Dad says, well, I'd like to get it for you, but I don't have the money. Everybody's poor right now. We're hurting. Can you pay for it? Well, that, under the way the straw man stuff is written by the ATF, that would be a straw man, and both of them would be in violation of federal firearms law. Unless Dad has the money to legitimately give Mr. Cruz a birthday present of or a graduation present of this firearm that he wants, you know, it really puts everybody in an awkward situation, because now you're going to have law-abiding 18-year-olds who actually wouldn't ever be lawbreakers to begin with, save for the fact that they want to legally purchase a firearm, and they have actually no means of doing that. So you're essentially, more or less, you're criminalizing, you know, these or putting people in a spot of potentially being lawbreakers who normally would never even think about that.
Well, most certainly, Ben, they're procedural lawbreakers, and because if they didn't read the straw man quotation in the notes and or know that law, particular law or section, they don't know what they're doing. And we find that quite often in some of the cases I work, where they don't really know. Sometimes we need to take a step back and actually analyze what was the purchaser's intent. I think that's also prevalent in a lot of investigations that go down that route. But if you look at a typical 18-year-old male in this country, he or she could go forward and join the service, serve our country, and potentially carry a firearm in defense of our great nation. They can cast a vote, which is a very important right. But incrementally, the last couple of years, they've other rights, such as the ability to have an alcoholic beverage or to go into a bar and they have to wait till they're 21 or carry a firearm at the age of 21 or what have you, has been taken away. Individual responsibility has been stripped away in favor of, call it an anti-state or some type of, we're going to take care of the entire populace, as opposed to taking, if there's a problem with a single person, let's address him or her. But they want to cast the web wide and say, okay, everybody's got to do it. And that goes back to, you know, America was basically founded on individualism, common cause, going forward, pulling up yourself with your own bootstraps, looking at a person in one's eye, your words, your bond, all that type of stuff. And now we're to a point, unfortunately, where you got to print, you know, warnings, contents are hot, on a cup of coffee. I mean, that's where we've gone, and pendulum has swung entirely in the wrong direction. When we have an individual such as Mr. Cruz here in Lubbock, Texas, who has all the qualifications of a going to be an outstanding adult, his future is unlimited, and we got to go through all these machinations through the court system to ensure his right. So, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say that one of the things that I find particularly disturbing about this is that somehow we've gotten to a point in society where now we're legislating when you can exercise your God-given constitutionally enumerated rights. I mean, it's bothering and it's troublesome to me that here you have somebody who, these are his rights endowed to him by his creator, that, you know, it can be argued are more essential. The right of self-defense or self-preservation is the most human and the most base instinct of all of them. And yet that's the one right that he really can't exercise. And that's the one that God gives us by our nature of being human beings and being born. And it's just, it very troublesome to me, for my conscience and for my moral perspective, that you have an individual who hasn't, you know, you're making laws and you're making it so that people have to prove themselves that they're not going to cause trouble, as opposed to prosecuting those who do. you're not prosecuting those like you should be when they make trouble and waiting for the, you know, in a free society, it has to work that way. Otherwise, you're not free. You can't legislate that away. And so now we've come to the point, like you were saying, of the nanny state or whatever you want to call it, where now you're taking away rights of individuals based on, well, it could something go wrong? Could something happen? Not, hey, you know, we're a free society. Let's let people be free. And if they make a mistake, well, then now it's time to deal out a swift and harsh punishment on that.
Again, that's why the last two Supreme Court decisions are so crucial to our overall pursuit of freedom. And I am supremely confident that we're going to be successful in this case. And we've got to stay tuned. This is one of the things that we do with the NRA. Sometimes people want everything yesterday. It takes some time. And just keep monitoring these things, bring it to our attention, give us a call. Our legal department, believe me, I spent some time with the guys over the weekend. They are monitoring a multitude of cases out there and working in concert with some other pro-gun organizations such as the Second Amendment Foundation. We go forward, and there's some we can't. There's limited finances. Believe it or not, there's limited finances. Economic indicators are down for the NRA as well at certain points. We have peaks and valleys. And just remember, your membership to the NRA, your membership, the cost of your membership, not one dime of that goes towards any type of litigation, political activity, get out the vote. All that is separate and apart. So it's something where we have to go raise funds separate and apart through a variety of different ways to afford the opportunity, because these lawsuits are very costly. And we're going to go forward, keep doing it. That's why we're here. And I think in the end, we'll have a successful conclusion on this particular case.
One of the things before we have our next guest on, Joe, is I want to, and I'm going to give you the last word here, but is it's important. You touched on the Supreme Court and the decisions and those appointments are for life. And unfortunately, with Mr. Obama in office, we have had two appointments that I'm going to just throw it out there and say are anti-freedom between Sotomayor and Kagan, of the, you know, nanny state appointments of people that these young women that he has appointed are going to be on there for life. And so what I want to leave you with, and I want to, like I said, I want to give you the last word here, but folks out there listening, your vote matters. Even if you don't like the candidates, even if you don't like any of them, your vote matters. So even if, and I know you hate to say it, and you hate to say, well, gee, you know, I'm going to vote the least of two evils. Well, sometimes that's all you're left with. Go ahead, Joe.
Well, as I always say, and I emphasize it whenever I post on the forum, elections have consequences. We knew going in that if Mr. Obama was successful, he was going to have a shot at appointing two, possibly three Supreme Court justices. That was perfectly articulated to everyone prior to the general election. He was successful. As a result, the election did have consequences. No matter what we tried, and I think people have to understand, they're in control. The Democrats control the Oval Office, the Senate, and the House of Representatives. They could have passed a lot of things. They didn't need any help from the Republicans. So take a deep look. Educate yourself in the political process. It doesn't take that long to really learn or brush up on what we learned back in elementary school about how things happen. But take the time, folks. I always say this. Register to vote. Take the 5 minutes to go exercise that right. Remember what happened overseas or in the sandbox in Iraq. And these people lined up for hours for the right to cast a vote. It takes us 5 minutes. With that, we can definitely make a change, a good change this time. So let's get going. Let's spread the word. Talk to our friends, our gun buddies, and everybody we know. Get in the register. And then get them out there. Take them out, make a party out of it, whatever you got to do, get them down to the polls, and then cast your vote for freedom. because elections have consequences.
And thank you, Joe. I couldn't have said it better myself. Again, that was Joe DeBurgolis from the NRA. Thank you, sir. We always appreciate having you on the air. We have another really cool segment coming up right now. Our next guest, as I'm sitting here in my office waiting for him to get on the line, looking at my M1A, and he was lonely this week, didn't get to take him out and shoot him, but hopefully this my little Springfield here will get out to do a tactical class next week. At any rate, our next guest is a gentleman named Paul. He goes by the screen name of Sylvan on AR15.com. He is, and those of you following along can actually go to the Radio Free ARFCOM thread for tonight's show. Go on, if you're on AR15.com, go to the General tab, click on Radio Free ARFCOM, and then go to the September 13th Radio Free ARFCOM show schedule and click on that link. And in that thread, you will find the Taliban Safari, which is a project that Paul's doing and sort of one of the reasons we want to talk to him. And if you go ahead and pull that link up, it's a very, very cool site. It's have you ever wanted to ask a soldier what is it like? It says war, battle, Afghanistan, being shot at, shooting someone, watching someone die, being gone from your family. It says the first question was he got a lot when he came home, and then he goes on to talk about answering all these questions. And then now he's working on this book called Taliban Safari, and the description is, in 75,000 words, I describe a single day in Afghanistan that answers all of the questions one might ask about what, quote, it is like, from the moment I awoke to the moment of going to bed, as true as he can remember. And with that, we have Paul with us from Alaska. He is a lieutenant colonel of infantry serving full-time in the Alaska Army National Guard. Got back from southern Afghanistan last year and doing some writing. Again, Taliban Safari. Paul, how are you doing, sir? Thank you for your service. We're very appreciative of that. And thank you for being a guest here on Radio Free ARFCOM. How are you doing tonight, sir?
Hey, I'm doing great, thanks. And please, just call me Paul. I get sir enough at work.
Excellent. Well, I hope you're having a good day, and we certainly appreciate you taking the time to come on the air with us. What? Tell me a little bit about your project, Taliban Safari, for the listeners out there.
Well, I modeled it on a book called Ivan Denisovich. I can't remember the author's name, so it's the guy who wrote Gulag Archipelago. And Gulag Archipelago is really, really long. And fantastic book, but it goes on forever. But his first work was Ivan Denisovich, where he wrote about one day in the Gulag. The time the guy woke up, and the guy went to bed, and it was a completely average day. But it immersed you in what's a foreign world for most people. You know, he brought the reader to the Gulag and lets you experience that. And I love the concept. It wasn't that long in the book. And talking about deployment is tough to do. So what I tried to do was describe it primarily for my wife, is really who I wrote the book for. And then expand on that. You know, it's difficult to talk about, it's easier to write about. So that was my way of doing it. As I kept going, I realized I'd have enough stuff for kind of a short book, maybe not too long to get everybody bored. And the word count's a little bit low for a novel, but I think it works. And I hope that it works the way Ivan Denisovich did, to kind of help people get an understanding of what it's like, you know, downrange.
Now, you said you were there with the National Guard unit, and I guess in your position, you're more of one of the – you're an officer, obviously, so you're sort of in a leadership-type role. Is that correct?
Well, yeah. Basically, what happened is, you know, there's 37 provinces in Afghanistan. Southern Afghanistan has six of them. You got Zabul, Kandahar, Helmand, Khorasan, Nimruz, Dikundi. And I was the provincial lead mentor for the police in Zabul. And so I had four teams in different districts within the province. And the fortunate thing was, even though I had a senior role mentoring an Afghan general, and I go over this, in combat, I'd end up, it'd be me, one interpreter, and 8 to 10 police, sometimes less, sometimes more. So I got to run the gamut from being, you know, in a lieutenant colonel position down to being an infantry squad leader in combat. So it was an amazing range of responsibilities and roles that I enjoyed way too much.
Excellent. Actually, we have, my producer just told me, we have a guest. We have Scarlett and Anna Lee from Kansas City on the line. Are you there, ladies? Hello?
Hi.
How are you doing?
Good.
Do you have a question for us?
Hi.
Yeah.
What's your question?
Where did you go to college?
Where did you go to college?
Are you asking Paul or are you asking me?
I got that. I went to college in a little place in New York, a small school, about 4,000 people. It's euphemistically known as the South Hudson Institute of Technology. It's more famously known as West Point. I think I happen to know the father of these two young ladies from Kansas City. Screech Jet is from Arfcom is setting me up for failure here. Thanks, Screech.
Trying to help you out, Paul. How do you think your education's prepared you for your time as an officer and a citizen?
Yeah.
Daddy. I'm sorry, what's that one again?
How do you think your time as a West Point graduate has prepared you as a citizen and an officer?
I guess it definitely gives you a sense of history of the nation. West Point, the sign of the site of Benedict Arnold's betrayal of the country, literally dates back to the Revolutionary War and the creation of the country, founded by Thomas Jefferson and Lewis and Clark, Corps of Engineers, and that's the foundation of West Point. So you feel a tie to the history of the country. And then just, you got a lot of amazing leaders in the past who passed through there. The joke of the history department is much of the history we taught was made by the people we taught, something along those lines. So it gives you a sense of history and your duty and obligations and a clear understanding of what the founding fathers were at least willing to sacrifice to get the country.
I hope that was a sufficient answer. We certainly appreciate the call-in. And you're talking about the fathers and the founding fathers, Paul, and how, I guess, that leads to an interesting question is how, in your knowledge of history and the understanding of the founding fathers and the founding of this nation, has that helped you? What lessons have you taken away from that to help you lead the people that you were with when you were overseas?
Well, it's interesting. The Afghan society has more than a passing resemblance to American society in the decentralized, independent nature of the Afghan people. They don't like to be told what to do. They'd rather be left alone in their own abject poverty than to get a small amount of material comfort but give up that independence. And the Afghan people are much different than the Arab people. I think sometimes we lose track of that. And I enjoyed my time in Afghanistan, and I got a good respect for the Pashtun people who live there, even understanding that, my enemies were, at least Kyle was that, were all Pashtun as well. But they represented they just represented a distinct minority of the enemies there. And the average farmer in Afghanistan really wants what I think the American people wanted early in our independence, to be left alone and given the chance to lead their life as they see fit. Now, we disagree fundamentally on how they live that life in many regards, but to impose our values onto a society that has functioned almost unchanged for 2,000 years, that seems to me the height of arrogance. So I guess it's that understanding of what we fought for, and it kind of helps me understand why they're fighting. Even if it's against me, I can't say as though I completely disagree. If a foreign invader came and then told me how I lived my life was wrong and that I had to change it, no matter how well-meaning it may be, I could see picking up arms just on general principle.
Well, that brings up an interesting point, and I guess the question that from then would be, was that the attitude that you encountered? Were people, I mean, as well-intentioned as I guess the military and the country is being in Afghanistan, you know, well-intentioned being that we want to, you know, kill the Taliban, but yet they still have, you know, obviously, like you said, their life, and they don't want to be imposed upon. And what type of reaction were you encountering? I mean, was that pretty common, or an inherent resistance to authority?
No, I didn't sense that. I got a lot of leave us alone. You know, we go to villages, we talk to them, and, you know, I talk about this in the book as well. You know, what do you want from us? And often it was nothing. Or it was something simple, like our well's dry, can you dig a new well? Or, you know, we'd look for some wheat seed. But because the Taliban were all over the hillside and countryside in my province, the biggest thing was, if you're not going to stay, then go away. They don't have security. And, you know, we're kind of mucking about in their playground and creating problems. They don't want us there. They don't want the Taliban there. They just want to be left alone. We chose the battlefield based on where the Taliban were at. And Screech Chad, his daughters came in and, you know, brought up a really good point. Afghanistan isn't the graveyard of empires. It's the football field. It's where empires go to kick the ball around and play the great game. And previously, it was the British and the Russian Empire. And then it was the Soviet Union and the Americans, you know, supporting the Mujahideen. So they're people largely tired of war. The young men who are recruited by the Taliban don't remember the Soviets or how bad it was. And even the Taliban's influence is a passing memory for the youngsters there, because it's been 9 years since the Taliban were in charge. So they have their recruiting points. As I explained to them, you have Pashtun Wali, which is the Pashtun code, how they live. And I always explain to them, look, we're here for Badal. We're here for revenge. And they understand that. They're cool with it. You say, why are you here? Well, they killed 3,000 of our countrymen, and we want to kill them. Totally cool with it. And as long as I focused on that as to why the Americans are here, you know, they were okay with it. If you start getting into, well, you know, you guys need to be democratic, you got to, you know, women's rights, blah, 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 they're going to shut you out or they're going to shoot you. So I try to avoid that in my day-to-day conversations. It's complex. There's no way around it.
That's a pretty incredible statement, because it's not something that, you know, I being a journalist and a student of media, and I'm so used to hearing things being, you know, pranced around, and nobody ever talks about the legitimate issues. It's always the politically correct, it's the politically expedient way of dealing with things, and then of course the media in kowtowing to their liberal biases. That, you know, you never hear somebody just tell it like it is. And one of the things, and without getting into a huge September 11th thread, but obviously it's relevant. I mean, say what you want about Iraq. Okay, that's not even the issue we're talking about. We're talking about Afghanistan. This was the home where the people came from or were financed that attacked us. There was a couple of issues brought forth on the AR15.com forum that on all these September 11th documentaries, I mean, I watched a couple of them over the weekend, you really didn't see a lot of who did it. It was what happened, but there wasn't a lot of, it was the crazy radical Islam terrorists, Muslim terrorists that set out to kill, to murder, to burn alive, and to collapse buildings on top of 3,000 American people. And slam planes into buildings and into the ground and all this crazy stuff. You didn't hear about who it was or what their beliefs were. And to hear somebody say, okay, well, we're going there because we want to kill these people. We're going to Afghanistan because we want to kill them. And that's – I don't think that that's the wrong attitude. I think that's the right attitude to have, because if you go to a place – And I'm obviously not in the military. I haven't been there, but it would seem to me, at least, that if you're gonna do it, let's do it. I mean, if we're gonna go and we're gonna go after these people, let's not beat around the bush. I mean, if we're gonna go and take revenge for our 3,000 American lives, I mean, let's do it. And I think that, like you said, in a country as primitive and as Stone Age as I'm sure most of Afghanistan is, that might be the only thing that they really understand.
Well, I don't say that they don't understand some of the other things. They just don't agree with it. But they do agree with revenge in that conflict. But it's got to be specific. They're an ignorant people, but they're not a stupid people. They're very intelligent. You drive by, you'd see a broken down truck, and the guy would have a rock and an adjustable wrench, and he'd have his transmission all taken apart. And you'd come back 4 hours later, and the truck was gone. He'd fixed it. These guys are smart. They really are. And especially within their own country and understanding the dynamics. I mean, we're newcomers in the literal sense. And so while they understand revenge and they'll accept that, they'll understand our presence there, they understand the nuances and their place in history. And the Pashtun people have been kind of screwed in the way that they were deliberately weakened by splitting them between what was then India and now Pakistan and the creation of Afghanistan. So I'm very Pashtun focused because I was in southern Afghanistan, and I think southern Afghanistan is the focal point. We're not trying to win the hearts and minds of the Turkmens or the Uzbeks or the Tajiks or the Hazara. We've got them. It's us or the Pashtuns. They'd rather have us than the Pashtuns. We're fighting for the Pashtun population. And when I use that to explain why I'm here, why the Americans here, I'm here for a badal, I'm here for revenge. But it's strategically, we have to define exactly why we're in Afghanistan. Operationally, my job was to help strengthen the Islamic government in Afghanistan directly through empowering and mentoring and advising police and becoming a good representative of the government in Kabul. That was my mission operationally. I don't think it was the best mission. But strategically, and we have this debate, we're in Afghanistan in many regards, and this is opinion of me and a couple other people, we're there to make sure the Pakistan government does not fall to the same Islamic militants that are very powerful and could possibly hold sway. The Punjabi government in Pakistan is not strong. It is weak. And our presence in Afghanistan serves as a counterbalance to those forces that would seek to overthrow it, those dangerous forces. So, yeah, we're in Afghanistan for all sorts of reasons, some for public, some for private consumption. But at the end of the day, Pakistan is the center of gravity of the AFPAC region. And if we can influence positively that center of gravity without going in there militarily, or at least overtly militarily, that's what we need to do. And that may mean we're in Afghanistan for a long time. And we may do things that may not necessarily strengthen or legitimize the Afghan government, but it does strengthen or legitimize the Pakistani government. So you'll see the operational mission conflict with the strategic mission. And unless you realize that those two missions aren't necessarily the same, it's confusing. It's difficult. It's the great game played over again.
Now, going on with that, tell me a little bit about the book itself and the process. You said sort of in the beginning, you touched on it, that you had your wife and kids had a lot of questions for you when you got home about what was your day like. But tell me a little bit about not just the book itself, but also the process of writing it and where where it led you, not only in your journey that you were there, but also in your journey as a soldier and as an individual.
Well, as a West Point graduate, you feel a certain duty to the leaders who came before you. And so, I wanted to measure up as a combat leader. Do you have what it takes to get people to do what they have to do? And first off, I'll say the soldiers I served with, the vast majority of whom were Guardsmen, were by and large magnificent. There were some deficiencies in some leadership, as much active duty, regular Army, as there was National Guard. But the vast majority of my team were 26 years old and below on the team I directly worked with, except for my NCOIC, Rob. And they were aggressive. You read SLA Marshall about men.
You there, Paul? Okay, we seem to be having a technical issue, but I'm going to go ahead and read you. This is from TalibanSafari.com. We're going to go to the synopsis and table of contents. It says, the book opens as the reader lays awake in bed early in the morning, unable to sleep despite the early hour. It follows him through the monotony of early morning in Afghanistan and preparing for a combat patrol of extraordinary length and preparation. The pressure to succeed for both personal and professional reasons is explained. A brief introduction of the Americans as he leads in combat is given. The youth, inexperience, and generational gaps. And the book continues through the meetings with the Afghan police with Zabul province as the background. Here, the chief for the province is briefly met, and the surprise that joining will be to police a new district unknown to you. Their police are untested in combat. But when the Allies unite, the convoy moves out into the Taliban-controlled plains and hills of southern Afghanistan. A village, uninvolved but important, is introduced, and the people in the daily lives of those villagers are explained to the reader. Continuing on, one second here, we'll see if he's back. Excuse me one second, folks. We're just going to continue on here. But anyway, continuing on with the synopsis, the places, the village, their daily lives, and then the forces close enough to start the battle and dispatch helicopters. Continuing on, the police now become murderous and nearly impossible to control. That's the ANP. It says the reader goes from killing Taliban to protecting them in 30 seconds and finds his life most threatened by the ANP he's supposed to be fighting with. The immediate fight over with, the reader deals with a superstitious ANP and sharply feels the lack of fellow Americans at his side. Finally, reunited with the American forces after hours of isolation in the hills, his relief is shattered as the patrol returning home hits an IED. The IED, ironically, solves as many problems as it creates. The story transitions to the chaos of an Afghan press conference with Taliban and Afghan government officials both in attendance. The disappointment of learning another man, thought only to be wounded, has actually died. Once safely back in the home FOB, the reader has one last duty to fulfill, to wish his now 5-year-old son a happy birthday. The impact of this sudden transition from battle to domestic concerns is felt by the reader as the book ends. The table of contents, folks, if you, again, go to TalibanSafari.com, is if you scroll down, you have chapters 1 through 11. There are 11 chapters, and Paul is back with us. We're sorry we lost you for a minute there, Paul, but I was just discussing with the listeners here your synopsis and table of contents. So take us through. You have 11 chapters, and kind of just touch on each one briefly and sort of let us know where the book takes us in this journey.
Well, the synopsis has it on the website, and, it is sequential. The wake up, fob life, crawling over, getting a cup of coffee at 4 o'clock in the morning, prepping the guns, briefing the soldiers, doing those things that everybody does. And again, the mission was extraordinary to me and my soldiers. You rarely get a chance to get into close combat with the Taliban. But for anyone who's been to Iraq and Afghanistan and serves combat arms or, doing convoys, everyone's going to understand that. The prepping, checking your trucks, going through all that stuff, talking about FOBITs and FOB Sergeant Major and, all the stuff that really stinks about deployments. And then getting out of the wire and just driving along, never knowing when you're going to get blown up. Until you've been downrange, you can't really get the idea of, inshallah, any truck can get blown up. The first one, the last one, you never know. And so I go over that. I go over what it's like working with the police initially, linking up. One of the key things about combat is esprit de corps. You fight for the guy next to you. And, you know, definitely with American forces, that was easy. But when you're fighting with Afghans, it takes a while to build that rapport. And I knew there was going to be a fight because of the planning and the UAVs. And I knew the terrain. I knew the enemy well enough to know there was going to be a fight that day. And then I show up, and the guy I usually go to combat with, he isn't there. And not only do I not know the guys I'm going to be fighting with that day, I don't think they've ever been in combat. So, you know, it was a kick in the gut. And then, but you can't turn it down. Too many things are going on. You've worked too hard to get to this point. So, hey, you got to drive out of the wire knowing that you're going to be fighting with guys you have no clue what they're going to do in combat, who don't speak your language, don't wear the same uniform as you do. And then, you know, we had to drive. It takes hours to get to the battlefield. They always fight outside the range of the mortars and the artillery, so you got to go where they are. And in order to get there, you got to make them think you're doing something else. Otherwise, you're going to drive off into the mountains. You'll never get them. So that's why I went to the other village, Sabakel, and we did what's a presence patrol, which is you walk around and say hi to people, and that's where you go, hey, what do you want? We want you to go away. You know, we want you to leave our people alone so the Taliban don't come here and we don't have firefights in our village. And I can't blame them that. Working with the Afghan police gives you the excuse to go places and do things that normal U.S. military cannot do because it's the job of the Islamic government of Afghanistan. But when you're working with the representatives and really kind of on the sideline, you get away with that stuff. And then, you know, it gets into the fight. The Apaches, God, I love the Apache pilots. You know, I wish they had better equipment to work with, in so much as the Apache is a very high-tech, computerized tank killer. And it does a pretty good job of killing Taliban. I wouldn't say it's the most efficient way of doing it, but it gets the job done pretty well. And, you know, and then I ended up in combat. I didn't think I would. I was kind of the reserve force hanging back, watching my men and the Afghans do their business working with the Apaches. But there was an opportunity, so I took my force, which was acting as a reserve, and kind of put ourselves into it. And we're able to get up close. And I guess the really hard part for me is, having been interested in military history, I knew on a theoretical level what close combat really is. But I hadn't experienced it, and I hadn't thought through it. And I'll let you in on a little secret that has kind of been discovered again and again, but no one talks about. Close combat doesn't exist. It consists when two groups of armed men come close to each other. In sword days, it would be 5 meters. Now it's about 30, 35 meters was what worked for me. One group throws down their guns and runs away or raises their hands up to surrender, and the other group shoots them. Not this close exchange of combat and gunfire. You know, they touched on a little bit during Private Ryan. If you ever watch Band of Brothers, there's a scene where Winter rushes across the road, but the smoke grenade doesn't go off, nobody falls, and blah, blah, blah. And one man basically takes out a company, kills some, captures some, because he wasn't the guy who's going to throw down his gun and surrender, and all the Germans were. And, you know, you shoot a man who is literally defenseless. And it happens in a split second. One minute, you know, he's holding the gun, and he's looking at you, and you're looking at him, and your mind has already made the decision this guy's going to die. And even if he throws down the gun, even if he, you know, puts his hands up and surrenders, that decision's made before any of that happens, and that is what close combat is. And I knew it theoretically. I'd read it. Patton talked about it. You know, some famous stories, 15 decisive battles. Goes over and over and over again. It's the breaking of the spirit of the enemy forces. That's what close combat is. And casualties occur when, you know, the cavalry are running down people running away. And, you know, it's true since Roman eras and the phalanxes and the Spartans. The real casualties occur after one side breaks. But that's not how we're trained. That's not how Americans are wired. So it was wrapping that incident around my head, which, you know, when writing about that was the last chapter I wrote, was chapter 6, which talks about that, because it was the hardest one to get to. I kept trying to avoid it. I'd get right up to it, and then I'd stop, and then I moved on to chapter 7. And then, you know, so that's how that works. So I started off wanting to write about that part, because that was the toughest part, and I ended up writing about it last. And then the book goes on. You know, you do that, you start questioning yourself, but you still got to keep attacking. You can't quit. So we keep going up the hills, and then this Taliban was up about another 100 meters, and he saw what happened to his buds, and he's like, man, I better surrender early. I better not let him get close. So So he comes out, he's got a machine gun over his head, you know, he's like, hey, you know, I'm out of this fight. And the Afghans start going crazy. They're shooting at him. Luckily, they can't shoot for crap, generally speaking. And, basically I stood between an Afghan soldier and this Taliban, and the Afghan cop was going to shoot him right there in the desert. And I'm like, no. You know, we're taking this guy prisoner. It's cool. And I was literally standing between his gun and kind of a standoff, and I know his finger's sitting on that trigger, and it wasn't on safe, and sure as heck had a round in there. But eventually, you know, I got him to back off, and I send the Taliban back, and we go on to the attack. We keep charging up the hill, and they ended up killing him anyways, just as soon as they got out of my eyesight. And, you know, it's just, it was a very roller coaster day in that regard. And, you know, you write about that, and you think about what your feelings were, and you go back to the history, and you talk to your friends who were deployed, and you find out, you know what, everyone went through the same crap. But for people who weren't downrange, they don't know what it's like. And it's very hard for people to talk about it. And that's why you have organizations like the VFW, American Legion, stuff like that, because it's hard to talk to people who weren't there and who didn't do it. And frankly, Rob, my NCOIC, who's also an Alaska Guardsman, wasn't with me that day, but we were in a number of fights together on other days. He got tired of hearing the same old story, and my wife really wanted to know. So that's kind of where we got from there. And then, you know, just, and the book goes on, and it doesn't get easier. And then just when I thought we were free and clear, we hit an IED. And, you know, one Afghan died that minute, I mean, you know, instantly, and the other one ended up dying later. And then, you know, and then it's, if you ever read Shakespeare, you got the five acts, but the third act is the peak of it. Well, that's kind of here. I mean, the third act is there, and then the rest is coming down. And then the tough part, when I deployed to Bosnia, you know, I got to talk to my wife once a week for like 20 minutes at 4 o'clock in the morning on Saturday. I'd get up early and crawl over to the talk and hope there wasn't that many people on the phone. But now you can talk almost every day. And disconnecting from that, and then just talking about domestic stuff, which is critical. You know, my wife has 4 kids when I left. We still got 4 kids. And she's putting up with these 4 kids, and the wives, with especially with children, have it tougher than the deployed soldiers. We can focus on what we got to do. They've got a million things going on, and they're scared snot. You know, they're scared that their husband isn't going to come home, or their wife now isn't going to come home, but they're dealing with the kids and all that other stuff, but they have to deal with that terror. I didn't have to worry about my wife dying or my kids dying. So let me tell you right now, you know, you see a soldier, don't thank them, thank the wife standing next to them, because they're the ones who earned it. But disconnecting from battle and then going and, you know, wishing my son a happy birthday. It's tough. And that's the book.
Now, let me ask you one thing here. How did you pick this one particular day of all the days that you were deployed? I mean, you know, that was sort of the thing you were talking about. You know, how is this one day different or exceptional or whatever it was? How is it that this one day is the day that you decided that this is the story that needs to be told?
Everything I did in the book, I'd done on other days. I dealt with IEDs. I dealt with new Afghans. I dealt with Afghans wanting to kill prisoners. You know, I dealt with shooting people before. But I never had a day when it all wrapped in together. And just the fact that it was my son's birthday, you know, just kind of really highlighted for me what deployment was about. Transferring from battle to worrying about my family and talking to them on the phone. The early morning, you know, the long drives, the monotony. Anyone who's been downrange knows those drives that go on forever, and you're just, you know, you run out of crap to talk to, and you're trying to stay vigilant. You get tired. You start nodding off. You know, all those things that happen, they rarely happen on the same day, and that's what kind of set it apart. Like I said, there's nothing in the book that's extraordinary. Just the fact that they all occurred in one 20-hour period is what was extraordinary for me, and then allowed me to keep the book focused. And you didn't have you talking about a whole year where nothing happens for a year. You read a lot of these combat memoirs. They talk about their train-up. They talk about, you know, hanging out at RSOI. They talk about boring missions. They talk about exciting missions, stuff like that. By focusing on the one day, which, again, not extraordinary, it allows you to immerse yourself into that. And like I said, and it goes back to Ivan Denisovich and how he took that format of one relatively ordinary day and was able to immerse a reader in a very foreign world. For him, it was the Gulag. For me, it was southern Afghanistan. So it's what I tried. It's what I wrote. I gave it to my wife. She read it. She liked it. Anything that happens beyond that is a pure bonus. So, you know, I'm out there, of course, trying to pimp it out. And, well, give your listeners, however many there are out there, something to talk about, I guess, today.
And real quick, we got another guest coming on, so we're going to have to finish up here in a moment. But where would the listeners, myself included as a host, where would we be able to find this full account, and how would we get a hold of it if we had people that are interested in purchasing or reading the full version of this book?
Well, TalibanSafari.com is the website. I'm working with an agent right now. I can't say he's my agent, but I'm working with an agent. You know, things move slowly. No matter what, somehow the full account will get in there, and it'll be on that website when that does happen, whether it's e-reader or self-published or gets published from a traditional publishing house. It'll be on that website, and if they're all RF Commerce, I'll guarantee I'll post something.
Well, that's great. I certainly appreciate it. And, Paul, that was a really, really cool interview, and I wish you and your family the best. And you, sir, we thank you for your service. And please make sure you check in with Radio Free ARFCOM, whether it be on the forum or calling in or talking from time to time. But I'd love to read the full account that you have for us. I'm sure a ton of my listeners would love to read it. So please keep us in your mind. We'll keep you in our thoughts and prayers. And thank you again for your service, and thanks for coming on the show tonight. And we're really looking forward to the entire version of this. And make sure you get it to me so I can read it. And thank you again, sir.
Hey, my pleasure. I had a great time. Thanks a lot, Ben.
Thank you so much. Well, Radio Free ARFCOM listeners, that was a very, very cool interview. Again, that was Paul Darling of TalibanSafari.com. About his experiences there. That was just a mind-blowing interview. That was really, really cool, and I hope you all enjoyed it as much as I did. And again, thoughts and prayers with not just Paul, but with all the soldiers and servicemen and women over the seas in war and everywhere throughout the world. Our hearts and our prayers and our thoughts are with you and your families, and as always, we thank those not only overseas, but also those of law enforcement, military, all the people out there serving throughout the country as well. We thank you. The next guest that we have on, this is like the show to end all shows, I guess. We have a very cool guest tonight. A lot of good writers and authors and all kinds of stuff. But next we got Stephen Pajak coming up. And I'm going to get him on the line here in a minute. He's Stephen Pajak, and he is the author. Many of you, let me just pull it up here. If you go to the AR15.com zombie forums, you can look on a post here, Mad Swine, The Beginning by Stephen Pajak. And it's one on the ARFCOM zombie thread. And you can actually look at it there. Stephen was kind enough to send me a PDF of the book. I read it. It was in a day at work. I couldn't put it down. I sat down when I was at the gun store, and in between customers, I read it, and I read it quickly. And it was very, very cool. It was a fun, fast read. It was interesting. It took me through some unexpected twists and turns and some places that I didn't really expect it to go, which is a very, very cool thing with a book. You know, you pick up a book and I'm a big reader of zombie fiction. I mean, I've got three or four zombie novels sitting here next to my M1A at my desk. And but it's nice as a reader of not just, you know, zombie fiction, but of all kinds of stuff. I'm a huge reader, and it's nice when a book takes you or a story takes you to a place you don't necessarily think it would go. So again, we're talking here with Stephen Pajak, the author of Mad Swine, The Beginning, and this is our special extended zombie tip of the week segment. Stephen, are you with us, dear brother?
Yes, sir.
How you doing?
How you doing today? I'm good.
I'm
thanks.
Doing well. Tell us a little bit about your book, about Mad Swine, The Beginning, and just give give us a brief synopsis of it before we dive into some of the details on it?
Sure. Basically, it's a zombie book, but not quite like other zombie books. It's more a story about the characters and the plot, and the zombies are kind of there to move it along. But basically, it's a story about the H1N1 virus when it was hot and heavy. You know, everyone was thinking about it, and I decided one day what would happen about these vaccinations if something screwy happened and mutated, and just kind of created these zombie-type characters. And I pushed forward with that idea after watching one of my favorite zombie flicks, Dawn of the Dead, the remake, and a Jericho marathon. I don't know if you are familiar with the show Jericho. And those two things kind of put together, and I came up with the idea.
And for those of you following along online, it's Stephen Pajak. That's PAJAK.com. And you can find it there. And actually, the book is now available on Amazon as well. And I'd certainly like to get a real hard copy just to read it again. But when we open up the story, it's a gentleman working at a university in Chicago, or the suburbs of Chicago, and this sort of just you're thrust into the story, and you don't really know what's going on. It's kind of like there's something crazy happening. People are just going on, and one of the things that got me was the realism of it. It was like, you know, as crazy as the whole zombie genre is, you know, this was a very realistic presentation of it, in that it was a lot of confusion. It wasn't people, oh, look, there's a zombie, gee, it's The Walking Dead. It was, Stephen, you really portrayed the panic and the not knowing what's going on very well. And how did you sort of convey that, and where did you get the idea for that sort of, you know, sense of confusion, basically, in the beginning of the book?
Well, we have some new security systems that we had put in place at the university where I work. Lots of things have been happening on college campuses in the last few years, so they had done a lot of drills, and I had been selected as one of the building monitors. So when these alarms go off, my job is to get people moving and out the doors, regardless of what it is, whether it's fire drill or anything else. And the last one we had, no one was sure what was going on, and it was the first one that they put out there, and there wasn't much communication, so people weren't aware of the fact that it was just a drill. And it was kind of shocking to see how people were reacting, and they had no idea what was going on. And I was just in the middle of that, trying to get people out of the buildings. So that kind of just put me right in the middle of the situation there, and I just was very observant about what I was seeing going on, and I used that in the book.
And one of the things that is a big, sort of like the first big event that happened in the book was you have your character, and he's deciding, okay, and well, the first thing I got to do is I got to go get my kids. And I'm thinking, okay, this is going to be interesting. The guy's going to make his way through town. He's going to pick up his kids, and then he's going to take the kids, and he's going to get home, and he's going to have his family waiting for him. And then all of a sudden, it's like a ton of bricks. It hits you, and what do we find out once we get to the church?
Well, that was probably the hardest part of the book to write, obviously, because the character is modeled after myself and family, but basically when I get to the church, it's kind of late outside because I had to go on foot, or the character had to go on foot. And when I get there, I find that my kids have basically been chewed on by one of these crazies, and there are a few other kids there in the room at the time. And when I was writing it, I thought, basically, what I do in this situation, and that plays itself out in the chapter there. I don't know if I should give too much away, but it was very hard thinking about, you know, the kids and what happened to them, and I was trying to put myself in it as if it were a realistic situation, which made it more difficult to write.
Yeah, not only, I mean, it was relatively difficult to read, too, just from a perspective of thinking about, you know, family and a guy having to go through this. I mean, you could very, the emotion was palpable in the story, and I give you credit for being able to write something like that, because it was, you know, it was, you know, it's one of those things, you know, yeah, you're reading a book, a zombie novel for fun. You know, it's a fun thing that we kind of all fantasize, well, not all of us, but a lot of us, you know, it's a fantasy thing, and we're reading it to get away or to have a sense of adventure, but then you, boom, it hits you, this emotional thing where, you know, here now you're actually thinking about, you know, it's a character a lot of people can relate to, just a normal working guy, he's got his wife and kids, and all of a sudden, you know what, hits the fan, and then, you know, all of a sudden, you know, he goes into a situation where now his family's basically, his kids have been taken away from him. But I thought one of the cool parts of the development of the story was that the character, he goes from that situation and basically wondering almost whether or not it's even worth it to continue to struggle, is he takes that, but he transforms it into a leadership role.
Yes. Depending on how you look at it, some of my readers said, you know, things had happened so fast and they felt that the character was a little bit callous, but I'm looking at it from the standpoint of things are happening fast and action needs to take place and you don't really have a lot of time to really mourn and think about the bad things. You got to really think about, you know, getting yourself out of the situation and helping those around you that are still alive stay alive. And the person, the main character, is, he also plays a leadership role at the university, so he's kind of used to being in charge of things, not necessarily the zombie apocalypse, but he's already a leader, and he just by nature is able to take charge of things and move forward.
And then we get to a point where later on in the novel, we get this conflict where we sort of have it. I mean, there's always the outside threat of the undead, obviously, or the crazies, as you call them in the book. But you begin to encounter a more personal struggle between not just the character inwardly, but also the community outwardly, and sort of tell me where you got the idea for that, or really getting into the human struggle, and how did you approach that?
Sure. As I said, it's kind of a zombie novel, but it's really more about the characters and the situation and the community. I had mentioned earlier that part of this idea came from watching one of my favorite shows, Jericho, and I had started thinking about the idea of how a small community would be affected by this, something like a zombie apocalypse or any kind of major disruption. And I just kind of took it from there. I wanted to kind of focus just on the small area. We really don't know what's going on outside of what the character sees, what's going on. We don't really know too much about Mad Swine. We really don't know what's going on in the outer areas beside what he sees there. But the concept of the conflict between the two communities really kind of grew out of the idea from the show Jericho.
Now let me just sort of shift gears just for a second. And you said that you have these ideas, you know, that you were watching the remake of Dawn of the Dead, which is, by the way, one of my favorite, you know, modern zombie movies, a really good real good one, and then the show Jericho, which I'm familiar with the premise of it. I haven't gotten to watch it an awful lot, but so you've got this idea now. Okay, cool. I want to write a zombie novel. Well, I'm sure a lot of people on Hair15.com want to think, oh, yeah, that'd be great. I'll write a zombie novel. How did you actually start doing this, and where did you, you know, where was the first point where you decided, okay, well, I'm gonna sit down on my computer and I'm gonna actually write a zombie novel?
Well, I had just finished my second book, and I was kind of going through my notes to see if there was another project that I can get started on. And there was nothing really there that I felt like getting into. And I had just, you know, watched this marathon on TV, and the idea started formulating, and I kind of sat down and I wrote out the epilogue. And I really didn't intend on this becoming a novel at all. I just thought I was going to write a little short story that I would post, you know, once a week, a little piece of it until it came to completion. So I wrote the epilogue, and it just kind of spiraled from there. Usually when I write a story, I kind of outline everything from beginning to end. I know who my characters are going to be. I know what the plot's going to be. I know what the twists are going to be. When I started writing this, I really had no idea where I was going. I wrote the epilogue and the chapters that followed just as they came. I never really thought about where the story was going to go, which is kind of odd for me. I really like to plan things out. So each week, and sometimes it took a little longer, maybe 2 weeks, that I sat down and wrote the chapter, I just basically sat down and went with it, and what came out came out.
Yeah, because it's really cool. I mean, the book's, you know, it's got a pretty good flow, and then, you know, I'm reading along, and all of a sudden, you know, we get to the point where one of the characters dies in the end, and then we have this conflict coming. So where are you in the process of continuing with this project? I mean, obviously you set yourself up to be able to, you know, make at least one sequel, if not an entire series of books now.
Right. Yeah, I'm actually in the middle of the planning phases. I have a lot mapped out, and fortunately I've gone back to my ways of organizing things. So near the end of Mad Swine, the beginning, I wrote the final chapter, and I said, okay, where am I going to go from here? Obviously, I can't leave people hanging forever. So I did start mapping it out, and I pretty much have about 90% of the novel outlined. And I was this weekend actually working with my brother, who's one of the characters is modeled after. And we were shooting around some ideas for that last 10% and how to finish it up. I'm actually probably at the point where I'm going to start writing some chapters out and getting a rough draft up. And I'm really excited about it. It's in the past, it's taken me, you know, a year, 2 years to write a book. And with this, it pretty much went within 6 months' time. And I think maybe within that same time frame, I could finish up the sequel. I'm really happy about where the idea has gone, and I think people are really going to enjoy it.
Yeah, I find that one of the things in particular, I don't know if this is necessarily true of all the zombie genre, if you will, but if, for example, the movie Automaton Transfusion, it kind of leaves you at the end. It's like, wait a minute, you got all this cool stuff happening, and then boom, it abruptly ends, and it's like a to be continued. Day by Day Armageddon by J.L. Borden is sort of the same way. You know, you have this book, and right when you're really getting into the thick of it, it sort of ends. You're like, oh, man, that it just – and in your book also, it's like you get it, and it's like, man, that was a – it's a great read. It's a cool story. But the reader, I guess, in a good way, you're left wanting more. And I think that's one of the real great things about it, is a good book that you enjoy, is that – you end it, and it ends too quickly because you always want to hear more from it. So I guess, you know, you said you have a real good idea of where the next one's going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm basically going to play a lot on the conflict now. There's really going to be kind of two wars, so to speak, going on. We have the conflict with Providence, the neighboring community, and we also have a war going on with these crazies that are just outside our door. I'll give a little bit of a way, but basically I'm going to start the next book where the first one left off, the epilogue, but then it'll jump about 3 months into the future, and we're going to see kind of where Randall Oaks is 3 months down the line. The first book was kind of... it wasn't so dark. You know, these things were out there, and, you know, the main character was doing his best to help people along. But there, not a lot of time had passed. They weren't really in the thick of things. And now, 3 months later, the stuff has really hit the fan, and we're really going to see how they're surviving and how they're going to make it when they have, you know, this other community there that's larger than they are, that wants to take what they have, and we still have the constant threat of the crazies out there. So we're really going to focus on those conflicts there, and we will see a lot of the characters from the first book are kind of gone in the second book. I won't tell you how that's happened. And we'll have a few new characters to push it along. But I think the end of the second book will at least satisfy people, although it may leave it open for possibly a third, although I wasn't really planning on that.
I got you. Now, let me ask you something that obviously you've gone through. I mean, we look now, and I looked on the internet here, and now you've got your book. You've got it on Amazon. Tell me about for those. I mean, I know we have a couple listeners out there that, and I've talked to a couple people on AR15.com that are interested in becoming authors and becoming published, and you know, potentially having some ideas of their own that they'd like to get out there. Tell me what. You know, obviously, if you look on StephenPajak.com, the audience, you guys can see that he has got some other books out there. Tell me a little bit and tell some of the listeners out there just what the process is of going from a concept to actually writing a book to getting it actually published.
Sure. Well, basically, the writing part took a lot of research. I mean, anyone could sit down and start writing out their ideas, but when you're really getting it ready for the public, for people to read, and you do your research, you really find out that there's a lot you don't know about writing. I mean, there's basically formats you have to follow, and you do really have to pay attention to your grammar, your punctuation. People do notice those things, obviously. But as far as the publishing stuff goes, there's many different ways that you can go about it. You have your traditional routes, and then you have your independent routes. And in this day and age, it's really a good time for people who are really wanting to start writing and get their work out there. Independent authors have so many more avenues available to them that they didn't have in the past. But I'll give a kind of a quick synopsis on the two publishing routes. With the traditional route, normally you're looking at trying to find an agent first, so you're submitting a completed, polished manuscript to several different agencies trying to pick up an agent, and should one of them want to work with you, then their job will be trying to sell your book out to the publishing houses and get you a contract that leads to the publication. It's pretty difficult. A lot of people have written books, and a lot of people are submitting their stuff, and unfortunately a lot of the agents and publishers are relying on a couple-page synopsis that you've written to determine if they want to look at your work or to work with you. And a lot of really great books that are really well-written sometimes get overlooked because the strength of their query letter, their synopsis isn't so great, and they just move on. But the route for the independent author, there's some really good websites out there like createspace.com and lulu.com where you can kind of get your work out there for yourself. They do have services that you can purchase and use, but with a simple program like Microsoft Word, you can really create your own stuff and put it out there for people to read. One of the benefits of, well, a couple benefits of that is obviously you have a larger portion of the royalties that come to you, but also you are in complete control of your work. You're not really having to tell to an editor. You don't have to really make changes to the manuscript that you might not want to make. So there's a lot of resources out there, and anyone who's really interested in getting their work out there, really look at CreateSpace and Lulu and some of those sites. And if you think that's not the route for you, pick up one of the literary guides to agents and read up on the agents that are available out there in your genre. Start sending your work out.
And what was the route that you chose for your books?
I went the independent route. The first book I wrote, I had shopped around a bit and was working with an agent, but I really couldn't get it pushed out to a publishing house. And I was really anxious to get it in print, so I went ahead and went with Create Space and got it out there. And after that, when I wrote the second book, I was already, had an account going, and my first book was selling pretty good with just the basic advertising that I do. And so I just went ahead and published it. And most of the stuff that I'm writing, I wrote for my family and my friends to read because I know it's things that interest them. So for me, it was a good fit because I wasn't really too concerned about getting my book in the bookstores. Just wanted to say, here, I've written these things here, and go ahead and enjoy them.
Now, when you get that stage completed where, okay, now you've written the book, now you have a choice of whether or not, like for your case, and for I'm sure a lot of other of the sort of the non-traditional genres, you know, zombies or whatever you want to call it, being one of them. But how do you go then from actually having the book in physical form to taking that and then either putting it in a bookstore or putting it on Amazon.com where people can actually, you know, where you can distribute this stuff and try to make a little bit of money on it?
Well, getting it into bookstores is pretty tough. But getting it on Amazon and a lot of the online booksellers, even BarnesandNoble.com and Books A Million, that part's fairly simple. With CreateSpace, which is basically an Amazon company, when you set your book up there in its printed form, it'll automatically appear on Amazon.com. And it'll also, if you select, they have a few different options. You could select a larger distribution, and it'll also appear then out on BarnesandNoble.com and BooksAMillion.com. So that's pretty integral into the process with CreateSpace, and I believe even Lulu will get it onto Amazon.com. But getting into bookstores is a lot tougher. A lot of them are working with major publishing houses. A lot of them want really heavy discounts before they'll carry it in the store. So that's pretty difficult. But most people are shopping online these days, so it's a pretty good market. And with the electronic formats like Kindle and all of the electronic formats that the smartphones and the iPads and the iPod and all those devices are reading, it's another good outlet. And you can actually put it up for a really reduced price. So like a Kindle basically is running at about $2.99 compared to the $12.95 for the paperback. And you're just reaching a larger audience that way too.
And speaking of reaching a large audience, where did you find AR15.com, and how did you sort of go about finding the zombie form and saying, hey, I think this would be a cool idea to get on this site and show them what I can do with my creativity and my writing?
Well, I'd been a member of AR15.com for about 5 years now. My brother had pointed me to the site when I was doing my first AR build. So I was on there mainly, you know, reading up and doing my homework on how to build an AR-15 and just, you know, surfing the forums when I'm bored at work sometimes. And I just happened along to the zombie forum there. And once I got started with writing my own little story there, I thought, well, this would be a perfect place to post it. So I just got it out there, and someone said, hey, why don't you cross-post it over here? And so I put it in another place, and someone asked me to put it on another website, and so I had done that. And I was just really surprised by the fact that people were really interested in reading that. But AR15.com had just been a site that I frequented every day, and they happened to have a forum space just for this little niche thing that I was doing, and so it was a logical place to put it.
Let me ask you one thing specific to the book. Main character, he gets in his trunk and he pulls out an SKS. Why did you choose an SKS with stripper clips of all the possible armaments for your main character? Many of, I'm sure, the readers on AR15.com are wondering, Why don't they have an AR?
Yeah, I kind of didn't want to be like everyone else. I didn't want my characters having these really flashy guns. The SKS in the book is modeled after one that I have, and it's actually one of my favorite guns to shoot. It's a lot of fun, and I just, when I gave it some thought, I said, what I carry out there, and I just didn't really think that I'd be driving around with my AR in the trunk. But again, I wanted it to be something that any man could just grab up. You know, an AR these days is a pretty expensive rifle, and I think anyone who was, you know, lucky enough to pick up one of the surplus SKSs when they were like $79 has one laying around that they could just throw in the back of their truck and make do with it.
Now let me ask you, if you're familiar with the Radio Free ARFCOM program, every week at about this time, we do the zombie tip of the week, and since we have our very special guest, Stephen Pajak, here, what is your zombie tip of the week for our Radio Free ARFCOM audience, Stephen?
my tip of the week would be aim for the head and shoot well. that's about the best I could do on the spot.
Alrighty, Stephen. Thanks so much again. StephenPajak.com. I got a link for you guys listening up on the Radio Free ARFCOM show topic thread. So check him out. Stephen, thanks so much for being on the show tonight. It is StephenPajak.com, and it's Mad Swine the Beginning. You can find it on Amazon, and he will be writing that next book. And we're all looking forward to that. So thank you very much, Stephen. And again, his zombie tip of the week from the author himself is shoot for the head and aim well.
Please Thanks be sure a lot to for having me. Much next... appreciated.
Thank you so much, Stephen. Be sure to tune in next week for another great show, including a segment about tactical training. I'll be taking an all-day tactical pistol slash carbine class on Sunday. So I'll have some really cool material to discuss here next week on the show. Please be sure to visit AR15.com and purchase a team membership. Let your voice be heard, or check in on the Radio Free ARFCOM forum. Also, please don't forget that there are some big midterm elections approaching rapidly. Make sure you visit triggerthevote.org to learn how you can help get involved. Because we all need to do our best to get out and vote and get family, friends, and coworkers out to vote for the cause of freedom. Thanks to AR15.com for hosting the show. And most importantly, thanks to the Radio Free ARFCOM fans. And be sure to accidentally the whole show to all your friends. And please visit AR15.com's site sponsor links and support AR15.com. by purchasing a membership in the AR15.com store. And that'll do it. This has been your Radio Free ARFCOM. Good night.
The chair is against the wall. The chair is against the wall. John has a long mustache. John has a long mustache.